Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 316. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois. Very delighted to be back with you today. Let me introduce to you the men I have with me. We have Jeff Waddington, who is stated supply at Knox OPC in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Jeff. It's great to have you.
Oh, yes. A delight to be with you gentlemen this morning.
We also have with us another regular, David Owen Filson, who is teaching pastor at Christ Presbyterian Church, PCA Church, in Nashville, Tennessee. He's also a PhD candidate in historical and theological studies at Westminster in Philadelphia. Welcome back, David. It's great to speak with you again.
Thanks. Good to be with y'all.
Well, we have a great episode lined up for you today. We're going to be speaking about Cornelius Van Til, but more significantly today, J. Oliver Buswell. Now, he might be a man that you're not familiar with, but we'll introduce him to you in just a moment and all of the significance that goes along with their interaction, even though it has been underplayed and to some degree unknown. We're going to do some historical work and explain the significance in just a minute. But before we do so, I do need to mention that Christ the Center is listener-supported. And as we say each and every week, we do rely on the generous support of all of our listeners to help us produce and distribute all of our content free of charge. We love doing it, but we need your help. Please visit us online today at reformedforum.org/donate. There we have different ways in which you can give. One-time gift, you can sign up for a monthly gift of $5, $10, $15. And those gifts really help us in each and every week to produce these episodes and put them out online and to cover our web costs as well as equipment costs. And we're heading to some conferences coming up. I'm going to be at the Desiring God Conference for Pastors. And we're hoping to do a bunch of other things in 2014, but we need your help so that we can do that and so that we can get Reformed theology out there and promote it and assist the church in the special way we think that we're able and called to do. So visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate. We thank you so much for your support of everything we do here at Reformed Forum and this particular program, Christ the Center. Well, gentlemen, we've got a very fun episode coming up here and a very important topic. We have a paper in front of us titled Covenant and Paradox, a trajectory for the thought of J. Oliver Buswell and Cornelius Van Til. David wrote this and delivered it at a regional ETS meeting. And we want to speak about these two figures, but before we get into who J. Oliver Buswell was and how he relates to Cornelius Van Til, David, why don't you tell us how you came across this figure and how you became interested more particularly in researching him?
Yeah, well, I did my MDiv at Covenant Theological Seminary back in the mid-90s, from 94 to 97. And if you've ever been to Covenant Seminary's campus there in St. Louis, and you go into the J. Oliver Buswell Library, as you might expect, there is a beautiful painting of J. Oliver Buswell hanging there in the lobby because he was a president of the seminary, a dean at the seminary. And the library there is named after him. And interestingly, you don't really hear a lot about Buswell there. At least I didn't when I was a student there back in the mid-90s. You might hear an anecdote every now and again. But you didn't really read Buswell. A lot of Buswell's materials are out of print, really. You know, all of them are. Although his systematic theology, the Christian religion, has recently been brought back into print by the Korean publisher Westminster. Is it Westminster Books, Jeff? Is
Discount that Books, I think.
Yeah. Discount, yeah.
They're the folks that do those others, those Van Til volumes that were the latest edition before PNR started doing the annotated editions.
Yeah.
So I have a whole set of those on the shelf.
Well, they, a few years ago, did the entire systematic theology of the Christian religion, which had been for many years out of print, originally a Zondervan publication, but long out of print. You know, Buswell had, admittedly, you know, some minor oddities here and there with his theology that perhaps in Reformed circles maybe caused his systematic theology not to endure, say, in the way that we would think of a Burkhoff or whomever. You know, his view of Melchizedek as a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ, or he had a view of the omnipresence of God that had a unique nuance to it. He was very concerned about pantheism really creeping into things, and was even fearful of Jonathan Edwards having flirted dangerously with pantheism. It's interesting. Buswell once said, this is in his systematic theology where he is talking about the doctrine of God, etc. He said Edwards was a great pastor and evangelist and and minister of the gospel, but as a philosophical theologian, it were better if he had not spoken. And the reason he said that about Edwards, for instance, is that he felt he was veering closely to pantheism. You know, and so all that to say, he had this view of the omnipresence of God that, how would I say, God is not omnipresent everywhere, but rather he is over and above the universe. The universe is sort of in the palm of his hand, you might say. So he tries to account for the presence of God that way rather than a traditional Orthodox understanding of the omnipresence of God. He was a mid-tribulational guy. So there are just some little oddities here and there that I think maybe made his systematic not as enduring. But anyway, if you're there at Covenant Seminary, you don't hear a lot about his theology, you know, as such. But how I actually became interested, that's how I became aware of him, but how I became interested in the topic of Buswell and Van Til, kind of stumbled into it providentially. My wife's family's from St. Louis, and so we're there quite a bit visiting them and so forth. And back about 9 years ago, I went to the PCA Archives, the Historical Center there in St. Louis, which a dear brother, Wayne Sparkman, runs that. He's the archivist and the head of that. Wayne does a great job. I'd encourage you to go to the website and check out the Historical Center because it he's doing a really, really good work. Dear brother and man of God. And so I was just in there rooting around, geeking out, see what I could, you know, get myself into. And I was just asking him if he had anything there by Schaefer, because the Schaefer Institute, of course, is there on Covenant's campus. And he said he didn't really have a whole lot of things related to Schaefer or letters or any of Schaefer's papers. But he did say that he had some of Buswell, and he had a piece or two of Van Til. Well, of course, at that point, I just became tingly all over and said, well, you have to show it to me. And he did, and it was a letter, a couple of letters between Buswell and Van Til, and a syllabus that later figures into my research, a syllabus of Van Til that Buswell had used in class, and he had filled it full of marginalia and lectured from it, obviously critiquing Van Til, as we can get into here in a bit. And one thing led to another, and I just started finding a few other pieces between the two. Well, that got me thinking there has to be some things, there had to be some things at the archives in Philadelphia at Westminster's library. Well, providentially, I needed to do for my doctoral coursework at the time an independent study, or I had to do a course on apologetics, even though my area is historical and theological. As you know, you do some courses in various areas, and I needed to do one in apologetics. And so I asked Dr. Edgar if I could do an independent study with him on Buswell, Van Til, kind of gave him the background, what I had found and so forth. And he said that'd be fine. I went up to Philadelphia and started rooting around there in the archives and just found just a treasure trove of things between the two institutions, letters, syllabi back and forth, telegrams, all kinds of things that then led into that sort of was an, you know, kind of an entree into journal articles, things that they had both published. You know, kind of took the debate that was developing kind of in its embryonic stages privately between the two, syllabi, letters, that kind of thing, couple of personal visits, then into the Bible Today and Van Til's published works, where he'll talk about Buswell, Buswell's published works, where he'll talk about Van Til, etc. And I just did a paper on the basis of all that research, and so that's kind of how I, you know, stumbled into it. It was interesting, the difference between the two men. You know, Buswell being a military man, he was pretty fastidious, had a secretary. Of course, he was an administrator, both at Wheaton. He was an administrator, you know, at Covenant. He had considerable secretarial assistance and so forth, and so he kept very fastidious records and collections, very well organized, of his letters back and forth. At the time, it's not so much the case now at all. It's very well organized, the archives in Westminster now. But at the time, it seemed that maybe Van Til was not as fastidious at keeping correspondence back and forth. So I really had to do a lot of, you know, investigation at both institutions to piece things together chronologically and make sure that I had sort of the whole enchilada of correspondence between the two.
J. Oliver Buswell and Van Til kind of cross paths for a variety of reasons. I mean, they're similar historically and formally for a number of reasons. One, they're both involved in the founding of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. At least they were there in the beginning, Buswell being there for a year and then leaving with the Bible Presbyterians. Is that correct?
That's
in 1937.
Mm-hmm.
So they joined with Machen for the cause of fundamentalism or conservatism. Once they were in the new church, I guess after a year, realized that maybe the friend of my enemy, maybe I need to separate from him too for various reasons of right. premillennialism, perhaps some dispensationalist things, although Buswell was a Calvinist. There were certain reasons why they broke off. But then, of course, you've already mentioned Buswell going on to be the president of Wheaton. He was also president of Covenant College or Covenant Seminary. Was it Covenant College or Covenant Seminary?
They were both together at the time.
Okay. Well, there we go. And for various reasons, was a very significant figure. And, of course, his name on the Wheaton Library. There's so many reasons why Buswell was a big figure. There's also many reasons why we know Van Til and why we talk about him all the time. But what has not been known so much, or at least treated in the literature, is the fact that they interacted with one another. Perhaps that hasn't been as much of a treated subject as for the reasons you've mentioned, that Buswell's works, theological works, are not really widely available. And it is nice now that the Westminster Discount Book Service at least is making it possible to get a hard copy of Buswell's Systematic Theology. Heretofore, it has been kind of gone under the radar. So what you're saying is you've found, and I've seen some of these in the Van Til archives, but you're finding material that is substantial and important to describe their relationship, but also material that no one would ever find if they did not look in these archives.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you didn't look in the archives, what you would have, really, prior to the republication, the reprinting of Buswell's Systematic Theology, truthfully, what you would have is very, very little. You'd have the areas in Van Til's various books where he mentions Buswell, treats Buswell, but never really at length. You would have a brief mention of Van Til and Buswell in Bonson's readings and analysis, you know, Van Til's apologetic. You would have very brief treatment in Mether's biography of Van Til. But as far as actual interaction between the two, the things that they were saying about and to one another, no, you wouldn't have it apart from the things that are in the archives. Because what's in the archives are obviously number of letters between the two, but maybe more substantive, more pertinent are the syllabi where, that, for instance, Buswell would take a syllabi, a syllabus of Van Til, you know, make marginalia throughout, comments, etc. Or there's one thing that there's no title to it. I call it in my research, I've titled it The Lengthy Set of Notes because that's what Buswell called it in his response to Van Til.
We should mention also the way these guys use the word syllabus. It's not kind of a program or schedule of class events, but it's basically an unpublished book used for class purposes.
Yeah, kind of lecture notes, really.
Yeah,
notes. So that's a good
substantial
point.
And often in prose.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which in some ways, sometimes when people read Van Til, and they feel like it's not the smoothest, you know, prose that they've ever.
Yeah,
you know,
it was a class syllabus.
It was a class syllabus, exactly. So you have those sorts of things.
And he's Dutch.
Exactly.
Sorry.
Exactly. But, you know, their relationship, it's interesting. You know, you talk about the beginning of their relationship there, Camden, you know, with the OPC, and obviously there were millennial issues. And I think another thing that led to that that split with the neo-evangelical guys were also sort of social issues, you know, fundamentalistic views of tobacco and alcohol, et cetera. But you know, Mether, interestingly, says in his biography, wonderful biography of Van Til. Love it. Actually read this thing in literally one sitting on a drive down to Cocoa Beach years ago on vacation the whole way down. And we got there and I had 10 pages left to go. And so I sat on the beach and read the last 10 pages. My wife was convinced that I had utterly geeked out. But anyway, finished it. Loved it when I first read it. But he said that Van Til's relationship with Buswell began when the Second General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church of America convened in Philadelphia in 1936. And that certainly was at the beginning of their relationship, but it seems that their relationship goes back obviously further than that, because when you look at the correspondence between the two, Buswell's awareness of Van Til arose, you know, in 33. And they started sending telegrams back and forth and letters and so forth. Buswell was a very, very capable man. Again, probably outside our circles, the name, you know, at least 20 years, 30 years ago, Buswell would have probably been a more widely known name in the broader evangelical world than Van Til, probably, because he is such a big figure, Wheaton, Covenant, etc. He was a very, very capable man. He was a medal chaplain in the First World War. He pastored a Presbyterian church in Milwaukee from 1919 to 22, another Presbyterian church, Grace Reformed in Brooklyn, from 22 to 26. And it was in 26, in the spring of 26, that he was installed as president of Wheaton. Very administratively capable. It was around this time that his awareness of Van Til arose and the correspondence between the two began. And Buswell recognized that there were, you know, epistemic, apologetic, methodological differences between the two that he wanted to pursue. And it seems to me that throughout the whole thing, throughout the whole relationship, Buswell was more the aggressor. He was more the one wanting to pursue, debate, you know, interact with Van Til's. I mean, Van Til responded, but he seemed to me to be more more the aggressor. And that debate remained private between the two, again, telegrams, letters, etc., a number of letters, until Buswell took the debate public in the pages of a magazine called The Bible Today in the later 1940s. Hmm. So, but it, you know, he went on from there, from Wheaton. He taught at Faith Theological Seminary. Then he became president of National Bible Institute of New York and then dean of Covenant Seminary in St. Louis. And he, at Covenant, was professor of theology and philosophy until he retired in 1970. He really saw himself as a philosophical theologian. And in fact, outside of systematic theology, a couple of his major works, which again are out of print, A Christian View of Being and Knowing, a book on epistemology, and then Thomas and the Bible, the philosophical theology of Thomas Aquinas and the doctrines of the Bible compared and contrasted. At the end of the day, Buswell was a sort of a modified, maybe simplified Thomist. He didn't feel Thomas was as biblical as he needed to be, but at the end of the day, he was Thomistic, and I think that obviously lies at the heart of the difference between Van Til and Buswell. Mm. But he retired in 1970, and the interesting thing, even though at times the debate between Van Til and Buswell was heated, and certainly Buswell seemed either, and I don't mean any disrespect by this at all, you know, he was a wonderfully godly man, clearly, accomplished man that the Lord used mightily, but it seemed that he was either somewhat unable or maybe even a bit unwilling to understand some of the subtleties of Van Til's, you know, thought, his categories, etc. And so at times the debate would get a little, you know, a little chippy between the two. But, you know, the beautiful thing about it really is that at the end of Buswell's life, Presbyterion was doing a Festschrift, that's Covenant Seminary's journal, a Festschrift for Buswell, and Van Til contributed a tribute to Buswell. And then at the end of Buswell's life, he was at a retirement home in Quarryville, Pennsylvania, and Van Til went to visit him and fellowship with him before his death. He had suffered years earlier a stroke. Dr. Calhoun at Covenant tells this really interesting story. When Buswell had a stroke, was in the hospital, Calhoun went to visit him, and Buswell was worried that maybe the stroke had impacted his memory, as strokes can do. And so he asked Calhoun, you know, can you check my memory? I'm worried about it. I want to make sure that I haven't, you know, lost anything there. And I'm going to quote some of Romans to you. And so Calhoun said, sure. And Buswell started quoting Romans to him in Greek.
So. I think his memory's there, at least that portion of it. Now, what are some of the criticisms that Buswell levied against Van Til? What were some things that he focused on and aspects of Van Til's theology and apologetic that Buswell took issue with?
It's interesting, and this gets back to what I was saying earlier. I think it is a matter of, and he called Van Til the fountainhead of presuppositionalism. And it's interesting, just if I can go on a bit of a rabbit trail here before I get into the specific criticisms. it's that very word, that very, you know, concept that Buswell really coined and popularized. Van Til, as y'all know, and as many of our listeners will know, he didn't set out to sort of imprint his apologetic as presuppositionalism. I mean, he used the term in two or three of his works, but he didn't sort of originally call his apologetic method presuppositionalism. Buswell claims that it was McRae who, in a private conversation, you know, who was sort of a nemesis of Van Til, McRae gave to Buswell the idea that Van Til's apologetic was what he called presuppositionism. And he said that to Buswell, presuppositionism. Well, Buswell later in the Bible Today called Van Til the fountainhead of presuppositionalism. And I guess the rest is history. So in a certain sense, at least in terms of popularizing it and making it known, it was Buswell who gave us the term presuppositionalism as applied to Van Til. And he didn't really mean it as a compliment. So the areas where he disagreed or critiqued Van Til, that was first, the idea of presupposition. He simply, when he called Van Til the fountainhead of presuppositionalism, I think what you have here, and again, this is going to sound disrespectful, but I don't mean it to. I think we have, with Buswell, a fountainhead of misunderstanding. And again, I don't mean that in any way to denigrate Buswell. I simply think he misunderstood Van Til at a handful of points. First, the definition of presupposition and its relation to covenant. Buswell had a definition of presupposition as essentially a prior commitment that we use, sort of a Reedian, Thomistic sort of approach to evaluating to see if that prior commitment holds water. And he didn't see Van Til's understanding of a presupposition, if you want to call it that, in its covenantal context, predication, you know, the necessary prerequisite for predication, et cetera. So there was a misunderstanding on the definition of presupposition. Secondly, Buswell seemed to misunderstand Van Til on the idea of the Trinity and equal ultimacy and Van Til's attempt to formulate the doctrine of the Trinity in answer to the problem of the one and the many and his language of paradox. Buswell misunderstood that, I think. And also the nature of creation. It seems like with both the doctrine of creation. Thirdly, he critiqued Van Til on creation. Van Til seeking to show the sufficiency of creation and natural revelation insofar as it goes. He misunderstood him there. He misunderstood him on the historicity of Adam and actually claimed that Van Til was denying the historical Adam, because at one point Van Til spoke of in the fall, it wasn't simply Adam who sinned, but, you know, it was humanity that sinned. And interestingly, even though Van Til tried to clarify what he meant by that, Adam as our representative, he's not denying the existence of the historical Adam. He's simply saying it wasn't just Adam who sinned, you know, all sinned. Buswell seemed to insist that by doing that, he was denying a historical Adam. Van Til's use of autonomy, the language of autonomy, Buswell saw that as Van Til essentially denying, kind of moving into sort of an idealistic, kind of a Platonic view, whereas man did not have actual existence, if that makes sense. When Van Til spoke of man not being autonomous, even though he wants to be autonomous, he's not really truly autonomous because of his covenantal relation to God. Buswell saw that as Van Til denying that man actually had separate individual existence, if that makes sense. And then finally, I think he misunderstood what Van Til was trying to do when he spoke of there not being true common ground between the believer and the unbeliever. I think rather simplistically, Buswell simply said, well, then there is no possibility of even discussing anything with an unbeliever. So some pretty basic critiques, right? Things that we've heard before. You know, another thing that he critiqued Van Til for was, you know, whether he realized it or not, being Hegelian. He said at one point, you know, I don't doubt your sincerity and your giftedness, etc., but you need to look at your feet because they're covered in the mud of being mired in Hegelianism. So,
Jeff, you have any thoughts about these criticisms? Have we seen these before?
Yeah, I was wondering what relationship this debate might have with Van Til's debate with the progressive wing of the CRC, but that occurs, I think, a little later, or maybe the two interact, but clearly Van Til was accused of being an idealist by others, and of course that's what the criticism about Hegelianism is all about, as a form of idealism. Mm-hmm. I did, if we can, go back to the definition of presupposition. Mm-hmm. And did I understand you correctly, David, to say that Buswell thought that presuppositions themselves must be justified?
Yeah, in fact, he talks about presuppositions. We all have presuppositions. He says this in his systematic theology on page 15. He says, in what sense do we students of theology presuppose our basic presupposition? This is his question. He says, there may be many answers to this question, but only one answer is necessary for our procedure. And here we have really a methodological insight to, I think, the difference between the way that Van Til viewed presupposition and the way Buswell viewed presupposition. Buswell says, one answer is necessary for our procedure. We take our presupposition as a conclusion arrived at on the basis of what we consider good and sufficient reasons. So, You begin with reason, you arrive at presuppositions, and then you operate from those presuppositions.
Yeah, the reason I ask you that is because of in light of perhaps Richard Muller's scholarship on the Reformed Scholastics, we recognize that the twin principia, principles or foundations, mm-hmm. of theology are God, who's the principium ascendi, the principle or foundation of being, and revelation being the principium cogniscendi, or principle or foundation of knowing. Those, by definition, and this is built into the definition of the word principle in its use philosophically and theologically, are not the result of being justified epistemologically. Presuppositions, by definition, therefore principles, are your starting point. They are not they are not themselves justified. They are the basis of doing other things. If we wanted to use, I suppose, if we want to use the language of foundationalism, which may or may not be dicey, but you may remember Alvin Plantinga, in his description of foundationalism in Warrant and Christian Belief, talks about beliefs that are properly basic and beliefs that are non-basic. Mm-hmm. Properly basic beliefs are beliefs that are not themselves built upon some other belief. And I think for Van Til, the presuppositions are by definition not built upon prior belief. And therefore, there's a basic misunderstanding on Buswell's part. Exactly. About what a presupposition is. Now, exactly. Maybe this is a historical issue. We benefit from the exposure of Muller's scholarship, looking back and seeing, okay, the Reformed Scholastics understood this, that the principia are by definition the starting point. They are not themselves the result of a ratiocinative process.
Exactly. And very, very well said. And Van Til bears this out. And this is one of the fun little benefits of doing this research, has been looking at marginalia in, for instance, Buswell's personal copies of Van Til's works, but especially for me, Van Til's personal copies of Buswell's works, where you really get some insight into what Van Til was really thinking, whether he ever went in and committed it to print or not, you know, in publication. You know, for instance, Buswell would say something in his systematic theology about, you know, as the greatest Reformed theologian Charles Hodge once said, and out in the marginalia, Van Til will scribble, he's obviously never heard of Bavinck, things like that. But Van Til bears out what you're saying there, because Buswell had said in his systematic theology, Jesus Christ, as the second person of the sovereign triune Godhead, as revealed in the scriptures, we find to be the central truth of the entire system of truth and reality in the universe, the truth so integrated with all other truth as to sustain it and be revealed in it. Because of its centrality and integration, this presupposition is, listen to this, subject to reexamination as often and from as many different viewpoints as may be desired. Now, Van Til writes, you know, handwrites in the margin there at this point in his personal copy of Buswell's Systematic Theology, this question, by unbelievers, ? And he bears this out when he writes in Christian Theory of Knowledge, and this ties into what you're saying there, Jeff. Van Til says, for Buswell, presuppositions are not the conditions which make experience intelligible. As a Christian, Buswell believes that when Jesus said he was the Son of God, he spoke the simple truth. As a Christian, Buswell believes that the Bible and what it says about God and man, about sin and redemption, is the Word of God. However, as an apologist, Buswell presents the Bible and the, quote, system of truth, using Buswell's language, it contains as a hypothesis which may or may not be proved true by an empirical investigation carried on in terms of principles which are not openly Christian, but which are distinctively pre-Christian, which means, of necessity, from a biblical point of view, non-Christian.
Ooh. That sounds almost like Carnell, bring on your revelations. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry to bring up reference to maybe another obscure apologist, but we're dealing with the... Carnell was a student of Clark and Van Til, and at one point... President of Fuller Seminary, but that sounds like a similar thing there going on. Yeah.
Well, all of these, think about all of those debates involving Van Til, debates to greater or lesser degrees, right? From Carnell to Clark to, you know, Schaefer. These things were Schaefer happening in and about the same time. Buswell is probably the less well-known of them all.
How does this all relate to specifically to Covenant in terms of... in terms of the presuppositionalism, or the Buswell's making a criticism of presuppositions not being justified, I guess, and how does that relate to covenant theology, or the idea of covenant?
Well, the way it relates to covenant theology, and I think I could just simply say this: it seems to me that Buswell actually admitted to Van Til that he had never been formally trained in a reformed, kind of traditional reformed theological environment, right? And he was something of an autodidact when it came to acquiring his reformed theology. It seems to me that Buswell quite eagerly soaked up what reformed theology he had by reading Charles Hodge, B.B. Warfield, and Calvin, although he actually believed that Van Til flew in the face of Calvin and the Westminster Standards. That's, you know, another issue. All that to say, Buswell did not have the kind of robust, covenantal, sort of fully orbed, covenantal theology that would have impacted his hermeneutic, his biblico-systematic method, his apologetic, etc., that he would have had he been steeped in Voss and Bovink, etc. So there was... they weren't really starting at the same starting line when it comes to the depth of their understanding of covenant theology as such. The way that I think covenant applies to to the apologetic issue here is that Van Til sees every man as in covenant with God, and therefore inescapably, covenantally, by virtue of his creation in the image of God, knows God. Knows that, right? God exists, and Buswell never seemed to grasp that. That's what I mean by that.
Oh, no, that makes perfect sense. And, of course, given his modified Thomism, that makes sense as well, we don't have the knowledge of God, natural knowledge of God, implanted in us by God. It is something that results as a... from a inferential process. Again, that's related to what we've already said. So there's no does he talk at all about the sensus divinitatis in Calvin?
It sounds like
he's got a he would misunderstand that.
Yeah, he would misunderstand that, and even that itself would be subject to this sort of, you know, inductivist kind of approach. And he believes, even though Van Til, and that, it's interesting you bring up, you know, sensus divinitatis. You know, Calvin's, our listeners will be aware of, you know, the cognitio insitia dei, the semen religionis, the sensus divinitatis. Van Til sought to explain to Buswell what he meant by that and how he understood Calvin and how that tied into his understanding of man's covenantal responsibility to know God. Seems Buswell never, again, either he was unable, and again, I don't mean any disrespect, but is either unable or perhaps unwilling to grab hold of it. And so everything then for Buswell followed that sort of inductivist, you know, method. He says at one point, this is very, I think, insightful for Buswell, we present the following system of epistemology. And this is in his book on being and knowing, which for Buswell would have been his, you know, apologetic or epistemic methodological manifesto. He says, we follow this system of epistemology. One, our elementary intuitive experiences are not mere sensations, but dynamic situations. Two, intuitive experiences lead to the acceptance of the outer world of things and persons. Three, intuitive experiences lead to the acceptance of the laws of reason. So our experiences lead us to the laws of reason. Four, by the processes of faith, an integrated comprehension may be attained, the primary factors in which are A, divine revelation, B, reasonable knowledge of the ontological world, and C, reasonable understanding of the laws of reason itself. So those primary factors for being and knowing seemingly on an equal footing are revelation, reason, laws of reason, and our experience of the ontological world. So he was definitely an empiricist. He called himself a dualistic realist. And at one point says that this is basically Reidian, you know, but he called it dualistic realism. Said it was basically Reidian. And, you know, obviously he cut his teeth in terms of Reformed theology, as I said, on Charles Hodge. Although I don't think we can make the jump from there, as I think Paul Helseth has so helpfully shown us in Right Reason, The Princeton Mind, which we did an episode on that this past year, that Hodge was, you know, just a bald Reidian, you know. But anyway.
Yeah, it's a little more complex than that.
Yes.
That's fascinating. So there's five other areas we want to discuss here. What was Buswell's criticism of Van Til regarding the triune nature of God paradox and the one and the many issue?
Right. He basically saw Van Til as Bardian in this regard when he would speak of the one and the many. And I think he couldn't understand the subtlety, the subtlety of what Van Til was trying to do. And it's at this point in relation to Van Til's doctrine of the Trinity that he said, oh, my dear brother, I don't question your devotion to the Lord and the Bible and your sincerity, but look at the mud on your feet. You are deeply mired in Hegelian idealistic pantheism.
Was he reading Van Til as affirming the correlation between God and creation by any chance?
Say that again, Jeff. I'm sorry.
Did he think that Van Til's notion of the triune God as the answer to the one and many problem, was he reading Van Til as affirming that God and creation are correlative?
I don't recall seeing him stating that, although it seemed his ever-present fear of pantheism, that could have been an implication of that. I think what Buswell was criticizing in Van Til was that it sounded to his ears as if he was wanting to have his cake and eat it too, that God is both one and many. And of course, we know what Van Til was trying to do in terms of answering that, you know, the question of, you know, unity and diversity of human experience, equal ultimacy, etc. But Buswell didn't seem to be able to understand how Van Til could say that he is absolutely three and absolutely one.
So you thought it was a dialectic.
The dialectic, exactly. And that's why he said, you know, he sounded Bartian, because, you know, obviously Bart said he was fond of doing some haggling every now and again, and I think he just sort of dismissed Van Til here as Bartian and, you know, Hegelian, and okay. this was a dialectic that he was lost in. And
I was wondering if there's a simplistic notion of divine simplicity working in the background here. Again, not knowing, just wondering, okay, is there the idea that God I don't want to, not having read Buswell, I want to be careful, but I wonder what his notion of divine simplicity is, mm-hmm. which, by the way, is an absolutely biblical and sound theological doctrine. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, though, what's going on, why he would read Van Til that way. And now, what was the issue with regard to paradox? Was Dr. Buswell just opposed to
yes.
notion yeah. of paradox? Okay.
Yeah, and I think that's where it comes in here, that he thinks that is something of a maybe a cop-out for Van Til, and that Van Til is not acknowledging that he's more Bartian than he wishes to admit. And for Buswell, he believed that while Van Til was a, quote, zealous anti-Bartian, and he appreciated that, he actually thought that maybe the reason Van Til was so zealous in his anti-Bartianism is because, whether he wanted to admit it or not, his own system right. was so akin to Bart. And so I think Buswell was really reading Van Til not simply but simplistically here.
There seemed to be some sympathies with Gordon Clark. Was there any correspondence between Buswell and Clark?
Yeah, there was. I've not delved into it extensively, although I did find one when Clark was applying at Wheaton, and it was really interesting. He wrote a letter to him assuring them that he didn't drink or smoke. But there was a correspondence between the two, certainly, because Van Til, I mean, think about it. Van Til, I think, became, for a number of these guys, I don't say a whipping boy, but he certainly became a focus,
right?
For you know, these guys, in terms of apologetic method debate over that.
Precisely. And so if you have a rationalism of the neo-evangelical variety, Van Til would be somebody you'd like to go after.
Right.
Because he became a well-known figure in the sense that his criticisms of Bart, I believe, were the first criticisms available in English, or at least full-length criticisms. Mm-hmm. And he also being at Westminster, which had received quite a bit of attention after its founding via J. Gresham Machen, people in the evangelicalism would have been aware of it.
Right.
And so it seems like he would get a lot of attention. Plus, he, you know, maybe wasn't the clearest of persons on a variety of issues, but we see right. him getting criticisms from Clark, from Buswell, also, as Jeff mentioned, from the folks at Calvin, the Torch and Trumpet and the Calvin Forum and all those fun publications in the 40s and 50s that were a little bit over the top in their rhetoric. People seem to criticize Van Til for the same things, and you wonder if there might not be an echo chamber, because there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of originality in some of these criticisms. A lot of the Van Til's critics seem to be saying the same thing. Now, from one perspective, you could say, well, that must mean that there were those problems in Van Til's thought. We don't believe that, but from another perspective, it might be that Van Til might not have been clear enough, but from yet a third perspective, it's that the critics certainly didn't understand him. For their own reasons, partly because they didn't understand his historical and theological context.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think key to that theological context you mentioned there, Camden, is his reading of Bavinck and his dependence on Bavinck, which I don't think we see.
Right.
I know we see.
Well, it wasn't available in English until 2003.
Right.
And so, at least the full dogmatics.
Mm-hmm. Think about the fact that you don't have access to the Reformed Scholastics. Turretin becomes available in English in the 90s, right?
Right.
Not the 1890s, the 1990s. Mm-hmm. And Bothic doesn't become available in English until after that. So right. There are major resources for the Reformed faith, deep theological thought that are not readily accessible to someone who, unless they have a training in Latin or Dutch. And of course, so that creates its own restrictions on this whole discussion.
It does.
And that's of course something we have to keep in mind. Now you noted also, David, that Boswell had problems with Van Til's notion of creation. What in particular was the problem there?
Well, I think this ties into his view of Van Til as, you know, basically an idealist, and he believed that Van Til denied the reality of creation as an actual existent entity, you know, and saw it as more of a construct in the mind of God.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is related to his concern about pantheism, of course.
I think so. I mean, I hope I'm not making more of that than I should be, but it certainly seemed to be something. If you consider his view of his nuance on the omnipresence of God, if you consider the way that he basically says that Jonathan Edwards should never have spoken as a philosophical theologian because of what he believes to be a veering toward pantheism, which I think, interestingly, I think, you know, Charles Hodge in volume one, pages 332 and following, Charles Hodge gives sort of a litmus test of what constitutes pantheism. And as a side note, I think Edwards passes it with flying colors. But I think
right, exactly.
For Boswell, that seemed to be a looming concern. But so yeah, he, and I think one of Van Til's, you know, really important works, and I think y'all would probably agree, is his essay Nature and Scripture.
Yes.
Which, you know, was in the Infallible Word, a collection of essays published back in the 40s by the faculty at Westminster. Van Til obviously insisting on the necessity of natural revelation, not just the necessity of natural, but the sufficiency of natural revelation. And so I think, again, there's an area where Boswell misunderstands, misunderstands. Right.
Now we should readily grant the legitimacy of a concern. Pantheism is not a good thing.
Oh, exactly. Yes.
Right? So, you know, let's make sure that we grant that we note that pantheism is an unbiblical philosophical notion where God and creation are blended, are one thing. What's surprising is that Van Til is quite clear and hammers away at the creator-creature distinction. So how Van Til could be guilty of pantheism or verging on it is an interesting question. And that, of course, relates to the fourth and fifth areas of criticism, the historicity of Adam and Van Til's discussion of autonomy. You had said, David, that Boswell believed that Van Til denied the historicity of Adam, and this has to do with apparently the relationship between Adam and the rest of humanity, what we would describe as the federal headship of Adam. So where does Van Til go wrong in Boswell's thinking about
that? Well, in the Fountainhead of Presuppositionalism, which was, I think that was Boswell, you know, really going public and roaring against Van Til and criticizing Van Til. Fountainhead of Presuppositionalism, he accused Van Til of Platonic realism, because when Van Til, you know, denies the notion of autonomous man, he believed, Boswell believed, that Van Til was denying that man, that human beings, actually held actual status,
right,
or entity. And Van Til, you know, tried to, you know, defend by saying, what I'm saying when I say that man is not autonomous, that he is covenantally accountable, and that
right,
inescapably so. But it seemed to be lost on Boswell. It seems at times to me that when Van Til would reply and try to clarify something, if Boswell had his mind made up about a particular category and his understanding of Van Til and that, it was done. So he tried to defend that, but it seemed to go nowhere.
So Buswell is concerned that Van Til is denying what we would call the creational integrity of human beings.
Yeah.
In other words, he's reading Van Til as saying that human beings are a projection of God's mind and not actual entities.
Just like creation itself.
Right. But is he not himself verging on suggesting that humans are ase? I mean, he wouldn't put it that way, but as I'm listening to the conversation, it almost sounds as if his criticisms of Van Til's criticism of autonomy would require him to hold to some notion of almost creaturely aseity.
I mean,
you know what I'm getting at?
He would never. I don't see anywhere in Buswell where he ever would say something like that, and I don't think he would. But at least methodologically, I don't know how we necessarily escape it. Other than, you know, he said in his sort of three lists of priorities, there is revelation, but that revelation must be adjudicated by our experience and our reason. And so, if not aseity, certainly a fairly stout autonomy.
Right, and again that. Some of this flows from his modified Thomism. I'm not surprised that he goes the way he does.
Right.
So when he reads Van Til talking about autonomy, he reads Van Til's criticism of autonomy, he's thinking ontological rather than epistemological.
At least precisely.
Like it. Okay.
Sounds like.
Now, with regard to the issue of Adam, is he thinking that Van Til holds that Adam and the rest of the human race are all one being, or what's going on there?
This is a frustrating point in the debate for me, really, because Van Til, in Common Grace, had said, and it was mankind, not some individual elect or reprobate person that sinned against God. Now, obviously, that's one of those areas where we might say Van Til could have been a little clearer. But right. Van Til tried to explain to Buswell what he meant by that was that there was not a representative man historically known as Adam. His point was that it wasn't just Adam who sinned, but that all sinned in him.
Yeah, like Paul does, I don't know, in Romans 5, for instance.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah.
Or, you know, in Adam's fall, we sinned all. I mean, that's pretty... Now, of course, Van Til could have been read to be saying that the whole human race was physically present.
It's like shed almost.
Then you're getting into the whole issue of what's the nature of Adam's relationship to the rest of the human race. Is there a natural relation? Yeah, I mean that's a whole bowl of spaghetti in its own right, right? Untangling the strands, but you would want to get into the discussion of representationalism versus realism.
Realism, and I think that's what Van Til was trying to do. He was trying to insist on by saying that he was trying to say this is not just that, in kind of a realistic manner, we were in the loins of Adam, and it was Adam who sinned, but that it was true representation. So it wasn't just one man who sinned, but by representation, all sinned. Buswell saw this as one more example of the sort of unclear commitment to paradox that Van Til had. And for me, in the whole debate, this issue here perhaps is the most glaring example of where Van Til probably could have said to Buswell, as they do on Monday Night Football, come on, man.
What appears to be going on here is Dr. Buswell is no longer reading with a judgment of charity. Now, we all do this. We all fall into this. And sometimes it's justified. But it's clear that he thinks that Van Til is guilty before, you know, all the evidence is in. But now moving to that last point, David, the criticism that Dr. Buswell had of Van Til on the nature or the lack of common ground between the believer and the unbeliever, what was going on with that criticism?
Yeah, again, fairly straightforward, but again, a misunderstanding in the misreading of Van Til. Buswell says there is a difference, however. Those who hold to presuppositionalism are advancing a negative thesis, denying that there is common ground of reasoning between those who accept Christian presuppositions. And again, remember, little side note, his understanding of Christian presuppositions, not exactly what Van Til would say, right? But there's no common ground of reasoning between those who accept Christian presuppositions and engage in the spread of the gospel and those who do not accept Christian presuppositions and reject the gospel. The inductionist thesis is positive, i.e. my thesis, Buswell's saying, is positive and partial rather than negative and universal. I think that's a key statement. It is held that ordinary processes of inductive reasoning are valid as a part of the method of evangelism. As a part of the inductive reasoning process, it is further held that there are areas of common knowledge occupied by the Christian evangelist and the unsaved inquirer or doubter. And Van Til, you know, I mean, he saw this as, you know, as Thomas. He saw this as Butler. So, again, it's a fairly straightforward misreading of what Van Til was trying to say about no common ground between the believer and the unbeliever. Gets into the issue of you know, brute facts and no, you know, that there are no God uninterpreted facts. If I can say that, there are no facts that are not God interpreted.
Right. Precisely.
Now, of course, does Buswell, is he familiar with the fact that Van Til is very clear that there's no epistemological common ground, but that metaphysically being created in God's image is a common factor?
Well, that came into play because Van Til attempted to bring in here Calvin, right? And the fact that the point of contact, he says, for the presentation of the gospel to non-Christians is the fact that they are made in the image of God, right? And they have, and this is where he talks about the, you know, the sensus divinitatis and cognitio insitia Dei, et cetera, that their own consciousness is inherently and exclusively revelational of God to themselves. So this is the point in the debate where he tries to clarify for Buswell that indeed there is a point of contact. The point of contact is within man as created imago Dei, and it's inescapable and unavoidable.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
But for Buswell, you know, operating from, you know, a Thomist, you know, perspective, and again because of his difference with Van Til. I mean, for him to call Van Til a presuppositionalist, yet at the same time, not at least let Van Til's definition of presupposition be what it was. It just was confused from the outset.
Does Buswell, or as far as you can tell, did Buswell hold to a notion of the human mind being a tabula rasa, a blank slate?
That's a great question, and I don't know that I have the answer for that, because when he criticizes Thomas, though he's a Thomas man, and you know, he wrote a whole monograph on Thomas in the Bible. There does seem to be in Buswell the insistence or the necessity of revelation as part of the toolbox. At the same time, man's encounter with experiential encounter with the ontological world, from which he, you know, then acquires the laws of reason,
right,
seems to me to adjudicate revelation. Now, I don't know that Buswell ever describes man as tabula rasa, but again, not aseity, not tabula rasa, but certainly very stout autonomy there.
Yeah, I was just curious. It sounds like there's a mix here. What you have some notion of revelation at work, but it doesn't appear to be in. There is no natural knowledge of God that is not the result of a ratiocinative or inferential process.
Yeah.
Okay, so that it may not be a strictly speaking a blank slate, but it's getting pretty close to it.
I think he's getting close to it.
So, David, how are you developing this for your dissertation, and what are you working on as you work toward finishing your PhD?
Well, what I want to do is, you know, look further at the relationship of this debate to some of the others that we've mentioned, Clark, Schaefer, et cetera. I also want to explore the relationship of this debate over methodology to the historical context of the neo-evangelical movement. You know, I don't think I could do justice to the project if I don't try to explore where there are things going on that would drive Buswell to go, you know, to be aggressive toward Van Til in this regard. Yeah, I don't want to say that there's no relation to the fact of the split that occurred, or the fact that during the neo-evangelical period, it seemed that a lot of these figures were really trying to, I don't want to say make a name for themselves, but they were really trying to set their agenda and their cause forward and advance their cause, understandably so. And so that's of interest to me. You know, what is the relationship of Van Til and Westminster to the broader neo-evangelical context? And I would really like to also, when we've not talked about this a lot, but I really want to explore the theological method question, that this is not just epistemic, but the theological right. method question as it applies to Kuyper, Bavinck, Voss, et cetera. You know, to what degree is Van Til's being steeped in Bavinck, how does that play into the difference between the two? And that came clear to me because I was a couple years ago in the archives at Westminster, and dear Grace Mullen took me down to the archives because I asked her if I could just go see Van Til's personal copy of Barth's Dogmatics in German. And I just wanted to go geek out a little bit and check them out. And so we were down there looking at it, and she asked me, she couldn't reach the top shelf to put the Barth volume back up where Van Til, there's some of his personal books in the archives there.
Yeah.
Well, as I was reaching up to put the Barth volume back on the top shelf, just out of my peripheral vision, the corner of my eye, I saw this pink dust jacket on a volume. And I knew exactly what that was. I looked over, and sure enough, it was Van Til's personal copy of Buswell's Systematic Theology.
Wow.
I mean, I just started vibrating all over at that point. It was such a wonderful find. And even Grace was very excited because she knew the implications of that for the research. I say all that to say, when I started thumbing through the pages, that's where I really saw in the pertinent areas, Doctrine of Man, Prolegomena, et cetera, in Buswell's theology, where Van Til would make comments related to Buswell's apparent lack of familiarity with Bavinck. And hand it to Buswell. Again, I said he was an autodidact in some regard. So hats off to him for soaking up everything he could from Hodge and Warfield. He just never had access to Bavinck. And it was interesting, I had a conversation with Dr. Gaffin, and we were talking about this project, and he said that in his copy of Van Til's personal copy of Bavinck in Dutch, Van Til gave to Gaffin his own copy of Bavinck in the Dutch. And he said, you know, sometimes I'll be reading it in the Dutch, and there will be in the margin, Van Til will have written Bavinck or Buswell. So I hope to get up and check out Dr. Gaffin's copy of Van Til's copy of Bavinck in the Dutch, and see where those kind of theological, methodological yeah. tidbits can come into play.
It's pretty neat. In the Westminster Library, there are some of Van Til's personal copies floating around in circulation. I stumbled mm-hmm. across one on accident. I was doing a paper on Van Til and British absolute idealism, and I checked out from the library a copy of a volume by a guy named Cunningham. And it was one of those history of philosophy kind of books where it talked about the different thinkers and their different emphases, and kind of like William Jones, those volumes. But this was focused on the British absolute idealist. And it turns out that it had been written all over. I was curious of this because I couldn't imagine that this book had been checked out very often. And knowing that I was reading it for the very purpose of understanding some of Van Til's polemical context, I asked Grace Mullen, and she said, oh, that's Dr. Van Til's writing. So it was his own copy in circulation. And it proved very useful because he did write so much in the margins.
Oh, yeah.
And it gives you a wealth of insight into what he's thinking and the connections he's making and the criticisms he's making. So it provided for me a very helpful way to do an historical work on Van Til and his interaction with Jesse DeBoer in the Calvin Forum, I think in 1953, where Jesse DeBoer was criticizing Van Til for being an idealist in a lot of the same mm-hmm. ways that Buswell was criticizing him. And without having that marginalia, I wouldn't have been privy to some of the things going on. So it was really helpful.
Yeah, early on, I think the letters were, for me, just the most fun to and I think, like you, Camden, I really, I think I have probably touched and read every single letter of Van Til in the archives there, as I'm sure you have. And so early on, that was a lot of fun for me. But I think as the study has continued, it's the marginalia that I find most, I don't know, insightful. And
That's when Van Til's not, he's writing and thinking to himself.
To himself.
And it's a little different than when you're writing a letter to someone else. Now, you might be more composed and work things out in a letter, but you're also, it's different because someone else is reading it. You're not going to rip into someone in a letter unless you're Jesse DeBoer.
Exactly.
It's true. There's one or two of those in the archives. Just think about what you do when you're writing in your own personal book, in your own personal library. You let loose a little bit, and stuff isn't always going to be really formed very well. So you can't take it as a fully worked out and published thought in the marginalia, but nevertheless, it gives you access into a thinker's mind in a way that is just not possible in a letter, in correspondence, or definitely not in a book.
Yeah, and then the fun thing is making the connections, and sometimes this is speculative, but, maybe at the very least an educated guess, making the connections between, what he's saying in marginalia to what he says in his published works, where he actually is dealing with that particular part of Buswell, and trying to make those connections, at least maybe what he's writing and where he's quoting Buswell from Systematic Theology. I can go to his own personal copy of Buswell's Systematic Theology and check the marginalia out and try to understand what he was likely thinking at that time. The debate cooled off. I mean, really the debate was most active, from the mid-30s through the 50s, so mid-30s, hot and heavy through the 40s and even into the 50s. By the 60s, it had kind of cooled off, although they would, Van Til would write about Buswell, but much of the correspondence had ended, largely speaking. But I think that's what makes it, touching, that when in 77, when Buswell was nearing the end of his life, Van Til goes to pay him a visit at the nursing home, and because I think at the end of the day that there was esteem for one another as Christian brothers and Christian gentlemen, et cetera.
It is. Well, David, this has been fascinating, and this paper interesting as well. The whole subject matter needs to be worked out and developed, and I'm glad you're working on this and researching. I think it's going to be really useful for the future of Reformed scholarship. How might people follow up with you? Is this paper, you've delivered it. Is it something that is accessible, or do we hold on until things are worked out in the dissertation?
No, if anyone wanted to see it, I'd be happy for them to see, this paper as it is. All of these sections, those six or seven areas that we talked about, those are going to be developed considerably.
Yeah.
Both in terms of theological method, epistemology.
Those are your chapters, brother.
Yeah. So, this is just an appetizer. This is just the order of hot wings before your steak and potato.
Well, there you have it. So people can find more about David. You can get a hold of him and also read some of his posts at his blog, teachinglikerain.wordpress.com. Jeff's also available at feedingonchrist.com, and you can find all of us in a variety of ways at reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our programs. You can subscribe to things. You can also connect with the online Voss group, which is basically going forward roughly one episode of Christ the Center per month, in which we talk about Voss's biblical theology with Dr. Lane Tipton. So that's been fun. Episode 2 came out last week in the timeline of our episodes. And we're excited to be able to open that book. And that touches upon a lot of the subjects that we talked about today. Federal theology, covenant theology, God's revelation, all sorts of things. I mean, Van Til is very much leaning upon Voss. He was one of his best and brightest students and most devoted. And so you'll do well to learn about Voss, and you'll end up knowing your Bible better, we hope. So visit us online at reformedforum.org. We thank you so much for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.